So we're going to continue our foray into craving. And my plan originally was to talk about how craving related to the other links, independent origination. And then I listened to Jerry's talk and it's like, oh, he covered that. And he did a really nice job of explaining how it's all intertwined and interrelated with each other. And just this connection with ignorance and the other sense doors. And so that pretty much wiped out my thinking on it. So then I started thinking about, what is it that I could talk about craving that would engage us to a level that we would really begin to take it as seriously as the Buddha took it when he first started, thinking about teaching and whatever. And I thought about talking about why craving is so intertwined with suffering. Why is it that it's so connected to suffering? So let's just start a little bit here. Jerry had mentioned that craving is also called this insatiable thirst. So I looked it up. And insatiable in Webster means it is incapable of being satisfied. Incapable. By the very nature, something is incapable of being satisfied. And so craving is something that is incapable of being satisfied. Some other words that are connected to this insatiable thirst, this insatiable word, is inappeasable. It's inconsolable. This inappeasable, inextinguishable. So whatever that burn is, it's inextinguishable. It's unquenchable. We can't quench it. Then there are some other words here also. It's ravenous. It's voracious and demanding. There's an urgentness to it, an insistence, a kind of pressing and yearning. Can you just see by the very nature of the words associated with craving, this insatiable thirst, can you see the suffering that is contained in the words themselves? The word itself, the nature of craving, is contained within suffering. By its very nature, craving is acquainted with suffering. It's intimate with grief and intertwined with pain. So there's a moment here, we got to get this, that craving in and of itself houses pain, grief, and this whole despair and pain that we go through. By its very nature, we are tied to it. And yet, even with a practice whose sole point is to end suffering, we are still hopelessly intertwined with it. We're still, you know, some of us have been practicing for like 10, 15, 20 years. I'm almost 30 years into this practice. So why am I so still intertwined with suffering, with this craving? What, have you ever thought about that? Like, not just the idea of, oh, craving causes suffering and I should not be craving. How come we still are then? We've heard it a million times. There is something in the nature of craving that we can begin to look at that will help us begin to put craving, I think, in a kind of a reasonable relationship with it. In all my years of practicing with this craving, what I've come to see is that the more I understand it, the more I have felt it, the less sting it has. And the less sting it has, the more it begins to diminish its power over me. Gil Fronstahl said that we should not be called human beings, but human desirings, so that we could begin to understand that by the very nature of our existence, we are always trapped in desire. A human desirelings, that's what he wanted to call us, human desirelings. So if I take a closer look at this craving, I ever since I've been in this teacher training, I've read so many suttas that I am like trapped in these suttas to get an understanding of things. Because unlike regular English words, there's a way that the Buddha would explain things that can really kind of cut to the core of what we're dealing with here. So I want to go through a list of different ways that the Buddha talked about craving. First, he said, just to put it bluntly, if you can't get any blunter than this, I don't know. He said, monks or nuns, so practitioners from my perspective, I don't envision even one other fetter, fettered by which beings are conjoined and go wandering and transmigrating on for a long, long time. So I don't envision even one other fetter like the fetter of craving. So there's not one other thing that is so glued to suffering like the suffering of craving. That is it. This is what we're up against. It's been referred to as bound. A person would be bound with the bondage of craving, their minds smitten with becoming and non-becoming. They are bound with the bondage of Mara. Craving is also considered an arrow with a poisonous tip, which spreads the toxin of ignorance through desire, passion, and ill will. An example is given that it's like monkeys seeking fruit in the forest. That monkey leaps from branch to branch to branch to branch. Whoever is overcome, another way that Buddha describes it, whoever is overcome with this wretched and sticky craving, their sorrows grow like grass after the rains. Encircled with craving, people hop around and around like a rabbit caught in a snare. The ensnarer that has flowed along, spread out, and caught hold with which this world is smothered and enveloped. This is Buddha. Like a tangled skein, a knotted ball of string, like matted rushes and reeds. One more. if its roots remain undamaged and strong, a tree, even if cut, will grow back. So too, if latent craving is not rooted out, this suffering returns again and again. I think all of this points to something for me. I'm hoping that you get a sense of how insidious this craving is, so that you don't get caught in this misunderstanding, in this way that we could flippantly say, oh, I'm just going to get rid of the craving. Just going to get rid of that craving and everything is going to go okay. I'm only speaking from my own experience. It seems like I would go to Dharma talks with Rodney and I would hear the way he would talk about these things. And I would then just carry it into my own sense of understanding. I'm just going to get rid of that. I'm not going to crave anymore. That became my go-to energy. I'm going to stop that. But I want you to know from its inception into this month here, both how important it is, meaning it was enough to have Buddha not even want to teach because he didn't want to deal with it. And at the same time, it is a necessary thing to uproot. It is insidious and it needs to be uprooted. I think what becomes the more, I guess you could say, connecting piece then with something that's that deeply ingrained and at the same time like a fundamental aspect of our pain and suffering, then this cannot be about just simply going and getting rid of craving. This has got to be about seeing craving for its truth and chipping away at that understanding, chipping away at our misunderstanding, in that we see it for what it truly is. When we can see it for what it truly is and chip away at our misunderstandings, then craving, whether it exists or not, does not have the hold on us that it has when we don't see it. You guys see the movie Shawshank Redemption? Good. Some of you smiling. I love that movie. I could see it a million times. It's okay. I don't even care. I always act like, what's going to happen? But the thing about Shawshank Redemption that's so beautiful, for those of you that have never seen it, first of all, you have to see it. And I'm hoping, I'm encouraging you to go watch it. But Shawshank Redemption is about a man that's put in prison for supposedly killing his wife, but he didn't. And he spent several years in jail. It was a brutal homicide, and so he got a lot of years in prison, and he spent several years in jail under some really, really bad conditions. And then he finally finds out who it is that actually killed his wife. And he wants that person to go to basically tell everybody so he can get released, because he's an innocent man. And he has the person that actually did the killing, and he can have him as an innocent man. He can become an innocent man. But during his time in the prison, he was an accountant. He began to do people's taxes. And so the guards and basically the warden didn't want him to stop doing the taxes. So ultimately his witness dies and he is stuck now in prison for the rest of his life. And so in that moment, of this kind of realization of what he's up against. He takes a spoon and begins to spoon out the dirt, a tunnel he creates in his cell, all the way out to the outside, past the fence, for his escape. And basically, chips away at this dirt with like a spoon, carries it in his pockets, and then whenever he goes to the yard, he dumps that dirt out and goes and gets some more, scoops it out, puts it in his pocket, and carries it out to the yard. It's like a long game, this long understanding that it doesn't really matter how long it takes him to chip away at the dirt. Because two things are happening. One, he is gradually making a tunnel and gradually moving towards liberation or freedom. And at the same time, he has a long sentence. So this rushing to get it done isn't really even necessary. This is what I think of what we're dealing with the craving. Is this Shawshank Redemption? This craving that we are up against is not something that easily folds. And we're going to talk about that in just a second. It's not something that easily folds. So we're in the long game. We're in the long haul. And what we're really trying to do is chip away at it. Shante Deva also said, don't look down on small deeds. He said something about even a small drop of water over time will create an ocean. Now, this is what we're doing. We're chipping away at something with a small little pickaxe. Just a little tiny pickaxe. That's what he used. He used like a jewelry pickaxe. But we're chipping away at this thing that we can't, in our initial understanding of it, begin to understand it. But more and more, as we chip away at it, we begin to understand craving, not as some Buddhist concept word that we know, but an experience, an application on life that we can see it. We can understand it and see it. I think the best example that Jerry gave was the ice cream, maybe because I'm so in love with Tate cookies, but this ice cream and getting this ice cream, for those of you that weren't here last week, so he said I'm addicted to Tate's, you know, chocolate chips cookies, but he's addicted to this particular kind of soy ice cream. And he had it before in his house, like a couple weeks earlier, and he ate the whole carton. So some friend of his asked him, what did he want? Did he want something from the store? And he said, yes, I want that ice cream, without even thinking, just got his ice cream. And sure enough, as soon as he got the ice cream, he ate it. But then he had this understanding, and it's the understanding. It's not the getting the ice cream. It's not, oh, I shouldn't have asked for that ice cream. It's not the, I ate the whole thing. Look at me. I'm just so bad. I was unmindful. It's none of that. What became significant is that once he ate the ice cream and he began to see, because the ice cream didn't do it for him. And what he began to see is that what was really bothering him is he was nervous about the talk that he was going to give. And that the ice cream is where the mind went, to take his mind off of the discomfort about this talk that he was going to give. Can you see that? That you can't actually see that reality unless a couple of things happen. One, you gotta want to get something other than the pain you're feeling, the nervousness or whatever the difficulty is. Two, you gotta get it and it doesn't work. And then three, you can see because it didn't work that something else needs to be done. This is what we're chipping away at with craving. We're not trying to not crave because it's too insidious for that. We're not trying to beat ourselves up when we succumb to our cravings because that is the nature of this. We're trying to see if we can begin to understand and see that craving in its realness, natural sense, as we go through this. So I've been investigating craving a long, long time. So it's sort of like I've come up with some things that I'm going to share with you, these little four little points that I've learned about craving to kind of help us begin to delve into this a little bit further. The first thing is craving is subject to wisdom. It's subject to the three characteristics. It is a conditioned phenomena. It is the coming together of some things. And when those things part, it falls apart. So it's not permanent. It arises and passes away like all phenomena, all conditioned phenomena. So when you think about craving being equated with the words, urgent and demanding, by its nature, there is this degree of urgency that arises out of conditioning. The urgency of craving is arising out of the condition that we happen to be in. So we happen to live in a world that's just involved in impulsive behavior. I mean, if you look at a television, when like a TV show is on, and look away from the screen and just notice the lights, it flashes like this. This is how much light is flashing at us when we're watching television. So to the mind, this kind of urgency demanding, have to have it, impulsive behavior is getting reinforced by everything around us. All the advertisement, all the world is poking at us. If you use the internet to order anything, all of a sudden, you see that thing all over every feed you have in anything, any context, anytime you go on the internet, you got to see these commercials because there's something in the algorithms that we are dealing with, that we are dealing with things that are designed to push our impulsive nature to get what we want, to have that happiness. It's constant. This understanding that it's subject to wisdom reminds us, oh, it's impermanent. So part of what we can begin to see is what happens if we don't follow the craving. What happens? What happens if I wait before following impulses? And you can begin to practice when you wait and when you don't wait. Because we have to remember in Dhamma the both sides of the coin are equally of the same magnitude. So the waiting is just as important as times when you don't wait. You just want to know what happens when I wait, what happens when I don't wait, what happens. Another quality, another thing that you could begin to see around craving when you start investigating it, rather than trying to just not have it or not do it, is that it has, that craving itself is a natural underlying tendency for us as humans. It's part and parcel of the human realm. It's part and parcel of even our way of being. So it's so habitual. You might even say it's instinctive. It has a way of drawing us in by its very nature. Because it's so, the reason why I think it's kind of instinctual, more so than I even think it's habitual, is because you don't even know. It's hard to even see craving. It's so ingrained in our thinking that it's hard to even see it when it's there. It's so fundamental to our life that you almost have to think everything you want, like, feel like you need is subject to craving. And everything that you don't want, don't like, don't think you need is subject to craving. It's all subject to craving. So this way that we go about our lives, we're trying to see that this craving is very much a part of who we are as beings. We're not trying to somehow or another be a practitioner that doesn't crave, because we all do, and it's quite insidious. The more, I think I wrote a note here that to unhook craving, this ultimate goal we have, to unhook ourselves from this entanglement of craving, you are an arahant. You are of the nature of mind that defilements no longer arise in you. That's what ultimately, when we get rid of cravings, we're going to be. So until that point of arahantship, we are all basically practicing with craving. Some words that I think come into play around the nature of craving for this aspect of how it is a part of nature, it is a part of our very nature as being human, is this word insatiability, that, but this inappeasement, this inextinguishable, unquenchable, these are the words that connect to our natural human existence. You can tell this, right? It doesn't matter how much food you ate today. I'm pretty sure you're going to eat something tomorrow. I'm pretty sure you're going to want to eat something tomorrow. And even if you don't have any food to eat tomorrow, you are going to have the desire to want to eat. And not just eat in general. You are going to want to eat certain things and not eat certain things. It doesn't matter what we do, the wanting part of our mind is still going to always come into play for the rest of our days until we unhook ourselves from this craving. And what we're unhooking ourselves from, I do not think, is the craving itself. We are unhooking ourselves from following the craving. We're unhooking ourselves from following this impulsive nature that shows up in the mind. And that is completely doable. If you go on a retreat, you may never eat oatmeal for breakfast when you're at home. But you will eat that oatmeal when you're at retreat. And by the fifth day, you're actually looking forward to that oatmeal, whatever. It's amazing. In the beginning, people kind of slop it in there like, okay, oatmeal. But towards the end of that retreat, they are making these concoctions that are quite intricate and beautiful between peanut butter, which I just can't get why anybody would put peanut butter with oatmeal, but that's something else. But the chopping the apples or the oranges, I mean, it gets quite intricate about how people eat this oatmeal, because all of a sudden the mind has gone into craving. My best example that I've ever heard or read about craving came from His Holiness. His Holiness, the 14th Dalai Lama, was going to a conference in California. I think it's part of that compassion study they were doing. Anyway, from his hotel to the university, he would pass what he called this electronic row, this row of different various electronics that were being sold outside. He said by the end of the retreat or the end of the conference, he wanted one of those electronics. He didn't even know what it was, and he wanted one. I mean, this is what craving is. It is not you that's craving. It is the nature of craving to crave. It is the nature of this human existence to crave. Our job, should we choose to accept it, is to not follow the impulse of that. And in the beginning, it's quite difficult not to follow the impulse of it. But as time goes on, it gets easier and easier and easier. And the punch and sting of craving no longer ensnares us, overwhelms us. It no longer enchants us the way it does when our seeing is not clear. So one other thing that you can begin, I got two more. One of the things you can begin to look at with craving, to see it and understand it, is that craving is thought driven. It's not the felt experience of the moment. It is driven by our thinking in relation to whatever the moment is. That's why His Holiness wanted those gadgets. It's not because he knew what it was and, oh yes, I need that cell phone. It's because he just kept thinking, what is that? What is that? And then our grasping mind naturally moves towards wanting something that looks sparkly, that looks nice, that looks interesting. And you know, His Holiness is a gadget kind of person, taking them apart and putting them together. Of course he would see these electronics and he would be like, oh, I wonder how that works. We should take it apart and put it back together again. This thinking mind or the grasping mind that we're dealing with, that's what we're talking about here, is this mind that grasps after. It fears separation. It's one of the main reasons why the grasping mind gets so much control over us. It fears the idea of separation. Separation from my stuff. Separation from, you know, the foods I like. Separation from the people I like. It does not like separation at all. And yet, inherent in the existence that we live in this human realm, the realm itself is impermanent. And so all things that we have as part of who we are is bound to fall away and separate. Separation is inherent in impermanence, and it is bound to come. So you have a mind that's by its very nature does not want to live within the realm that we're in. Instead, what our grasping mind does is analyze, evaluates, you know, compares, gets into all these little intricacies about what it experiences through the sense doors. And that thing itself feeds our, it feeds our feeling tones, these evaluations, these thoughts. It feeds our feeling tones as to what is good and bad and pleasant and right and wrong. And it just feeds us. And we never really stop to think, I shouldn't say we never, but when we don't stop to think, what is it that's feeding this I don't like or this is not good? If we don't stop to investigate that, we won't see the grasping mind. All we see is, I don't like that. This is not okay. This is not good. This has got to stop. So what we're actually doing is practicing within the foundations of mindfulness, those four establishments of mindfulness, to begin to develop and cultivate a wise attention about what's happening. We're not, it's not so much about trying to get rid of the craving as much as having the wise attention or the mindfulness to help us know the distinction between the mind's wanting something and the present moment experience we're having, which is what ultimately I think Jerry got to around the ice cream. So some words, the word, you know, those words I told you about, I thought about some of those words that come into play here is this felt sense of a pressurer, something that's putting pressure on me to do something, or this insistent nature that the mind has. There's a way in which the difficulty we're up against is not the wanting, but the mind's insistent that if it wants something, you get it. I don't know if I ever told you guys this, but I'd say it was probably about 6 months after my mother died. My mother used to cook a lot. She loved cooking. But she cooked a lot of casseroles and things like that and, you know, big, huge meals. And I just didn't cook like that anymore. And it was only me, so I don't really cook big, giant meals like that. And so usually I get some little tiny thing, like one potato or something. But I had a meeting with a friend of mine, and I didn't have any creamer, half and half for the tea. So I said, I'm going to be a little late. I'm going to run to the store, get some creamer, come right back. But on the way, I put in my headsets and I was listening to old, you know, Motown music. And this song, I'm So Lonesome I Could Cry by Al Green, which was what my, one of my mother's favorite songs. It came on right in the dairy section. And I know it came on in the dairy section because of what happened after that. I did not know it came on at the time. If I had known, I would have saved myself a lot of grief. But somehow, when that song came on, I began to think of Mama And I started buying things, getting things in my cart for Mama. I actually got all the makings of tuna casserole, potato casserole, bean casserole. I mean, I was going over that whole store, getting all these casserole ingredients that my mother made. I got refrigerated biscuits that I don't even use ever. She did always. And it wasn't until I get to the counter now, it's about an hour into the grocery store shopping, and I ring it up and it's $84, that it hit me. Wait, I was going for a little bitty thing of half and half, and I've got all this food, $84 worth of food. And when I got out of the store, I called my friend. She's like, where have you been? I thought you were just going to run to the store. It was over an hour. I lost an entire hour. Not because I kind of forced myself to be mindful. I'm telling you this because there's a way in which the grasping mind hijacks us, hijacks our thinking. And if you're not careful, when you come out of the hijack, you will punish yourself for what happened during the hijacked time. This is not where I think Dhamma is pointing. Not the punishing of myself for getting hijacked, but for the awareness of exactly what happened. And that's what I did. I looked at all those groceries and sat there and see if I could remember how this came to be. How did it come to be that I spent $84 and an hour in the store? That's how I knew it happened when the song came on and I knew that I got lost in Mama. She must have been hungry in heaven, channeling me to try to get something to eat. But I could see the refrigerated biscuits and it all began to come into play. And I could see what I did. But when you see that in reality as an experience, you can begin to rethink how you look at this craving, how insidious it is. Okay, this is the last one. It's short. Craving dwells in permanency. So part of what a good portion of what Jerry was pointing to, so if you haven't ever, if you didn't see, come to his talk last night, it really would be a good idea because he does such a beautiful job of explaining this. But one of the things that he brought out is the relationship with these other links. And part of the relationship of the other links is that it becomes us. It becomes me. I need all of these things. I have to have it. It is me. It's almost like a sense of denying myself if I don't follow this thinking mind. The permanency of craving becomes connected, interwoven, interlaced with who I think I am. And that wovenness is why we can't get away from it. Because it's almost like we're saying to ourselves, I gotta get away from me. I gotta get away from me. How's that possible? It's me. And that sense of meanness at the craving moment. This is the weak end. I mean, I talked about all those things that the Buddha said about craving, but we're on the weak end of the self. And we still have 4 more months to go that's going to strengthen this weakened of the self. And it's so insidious that it is a natural outgrowth of craving that we are heading towards suffering. We are heading towards it. This whole thing that we're dealing with is not going to go away too soon. We're not even, it can't be I'm working on getting rid of craving. It's got to be that I'm working on bringing the practice into my everyday existence so that the practice itself, the Eightfold Path, the taking of the refuges, the precepts, all of this is interwoven into our lives the same way craving is interwoven into our lives. And the more clearer and comprehending that we get around craving, the less impactful it is. The less kind of grasping it has towards us. I think that's it pretty much. I wanted to get to what the Buddha called, there's 18 internal verbalizations and 18 external verbalizations. Well, I'll have to do those next week because it helps us see this whole selfing kind of thing that we're doing. I don't think any being in the world, I don't think any being or plant, any living being in the world craves like we do, craves the way we do. So I want to end with this poem called The Moment by Margaret Atwood. And Margaret says, the moment when, after many years of hard work and a long voyage, you stand in the center of your room, your house, your half acre, square mile, island, country, knowing at last how you got there, and say, I own this. It is the same moment when the trees unloose their soft arms from around you, the birds take back their language, the cliffs fissure and collapse, the air moves back from you like a wave and you can't breathe. No, they whisper, you own nothing. You were a visitor, time after time, climbing the hill, planting the flag, proclaiming, we never belonged to you. You never found us. It was always the other way around. So let's sit a moment. Thank you so much for your kind attention. It's great attention when you're on Zoom because nobody says anything. No coughing, no nothing. You can't hear nothing. Just me talking. It's like a strange phenomena. Anyway, so let's see if there's any questions about this craving that we're tackling.
Twary. Do you think, I really liked a lot that you led with that poem, and I just kept coming back to that, a little bit of gentleness. It was so perfect. Mm-hmm. Do you think there's a part of craving that wants to that is craving the present moment?
I think what I would say is there's a little part of us that's craving the present moment, like the heart.
Yes.
I think the craving gets in the way of that. So I don't know if it's the, I don't know. I guess what I'm saying is I don't know if it's the craving that wants the present moment, but there's a part of our wisdom that wants that's what you're pointing to is this, there's an aspect of us that really would much prefer the discipline, the presence, the renunciation, the willingness to not follow these impulses. That is what I think ultimately we would prefer. I don't think we want to live like this monkey swinging from wanting to wanting to wanting to wanting, but we're trapped by it because it's so insidious. And so this is something that we have to actually kind of like train ourselves. It's strange because that's what the Buddha, those were the three vows, is basically to do no harm. That makes sense. Okay, any spiritual path would say, okay, let's not harm anybody. And then to be kind, that makes sense. But then to renounce this renunciate, and I think that's what it's pointing to, that deep inside, we want the heart to be rested, the mind to be stilled, and not follow these impulses so much. Good, thank you. I see you, Ron, your little blue hand there, the little, see what you have? You're muted though, so I know you hear you, but we can't hear you.
There we go. So on the craving is like an independent thing, it seems like. You know, it's like survival. Like it just wants and wants. And I think there gets to be more of us, and especially in this world now, it's that everybody's saying, get this, it'll help you live better. You get this, you'll survive if you get this. And we just have to pull back. You know, everybody wants you to feel like you're going to survive if you got what they have. So,
that's right.
So I think it's just learning to work with that, you know, that it's like I've heard so many people say, oh, well, I really wanted this ice cream or something, but then I got four blocks away and I didn't want it anymore.
Yeah.
It was no longer necessary for my survival.
That's right. I do think that this is craving, that this is survival.
Yeah.
If I can be so weird about it, I think this craving or grasping mind, this is probably going to sound a little woo-woo for some of you guys, but I can get a little mystic. I can kind of go out there a little bit. I mean, I've seen some stuff. So I think in some respects, if you were to give a personification, give a kind of a characterization to a certain thought in your mind, like I want the ice cream or I need this to survive. These thoughts that we have about who we should be and how we should be. That thought in and of itself, if you move on past it, it's going to die. And so there's a way in which our mind, this grasping mind, is self-centered around its own thinking. So that you will, if you think about it, the more you think about something, the more alive it is. So it's as if these thoughts that we have are constantly asserting themselves into our existence so that it's always alive. It's always there. Because the idea that this part of me would die, this part of me would die, this part of me would die if I keep letting these thoughts go. But it's not dying. That's the thing that I think survival is a weird concept because consciousness, even from a Buddhist perspective, is going to survive. It's the nature of karma. It's going to just keep carrying on. Actions just keep carrying on, you know, until they come to their natural end. So this idea that dying is the thing I want to prevent, it doesn't make sense to the heart. I think this is what Kubble was pointing to. It doesn't make sense to the heart because all things die. All things end. All things terminate in some way. But I do think you're pointing, Ron, to a big part of our craving is connected to survival. Survival in all its form, both the body, our opinions, our thoughts, all of it is trying to survive and stay in some state of permanency.
A lot of it is just tempering, you know, just tempering the craving and then replacing maybe a craving for something that's not so healthy mentally or physically to something, you know, maybe in the teachings or something like that. So
that's right.
Just compassion. Instead of wanting ice cream, I talk to somebody over here that seems like they can use a little help or whatever, you know.
That's right. But keep in mind that if you go to the ice cream, it's fine.
Yeah. Oh,
just
yeah.
Just begin to understand what is it, how did that getting the ice cream and eating it come to be? So yeah. That you begin to understand craving, you got to both give in to craving and not give in to it in order for us to fully understand it.
I agree. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. Okay, you guys. We're about to go into clinging in a couple of weeks, and it gets awfully sticky. Somebody said something. I don't want to interrupt.
Yeah, this is me, Tori. Can you hear me?
Hi, Sarah. I can hear you, yes.
Hi. Maybe what you and Ron are sort of pointing to is that, like, comfort in the belief that I'll be okay without the thing I'm craving.
Yes. That's what we're pointing to.
I want the ice cream because I'm uncomfortable about the talk, but can I believe that just being uncomfortable about the talk is okay?
That's right.
I want whatever it is. Like today I found out that someone who I'm working with, I can't continue working with because her insurance won't cover our relationship. And I found myself really negotiating how our relationship should and could continue.
Yeah.
And then I reflected on it and I was like, actually, like, that's okay. Like, I can be okay letting her go and she can find someone else to work with. And I realized it was craving to keep our relationship together. And the other side of it was I'm okay without it.
Yeah. That's it. This is all about discomfort and learning to be okay with discomfort. It's amazing what we will go to, the lengths we will go to not to experience discomfort. And most of what we consider discomfort at this point is society's telling us that this, to not have this means you're going to be in discomfort. But learning to live with discomfort is fundamentally how we chip away at craving. It's just not easy because of all of these pressure, yearnings, kind of voracious, ravenous kind of energy that push up against us, this insisting that we have comfort. And to a mind as ours, it cannot tolerate discomfort in any form. So this is what we're learning here. This is what we're practicing around.
Thank you.
You're welcome. So I'll see if there's one more. If not, it'll probably be good for me to finally not put the person that has to read the announcements with 2 minutes left to go. Rob would probably appreciate it. Say, Tori, can I have a breather? All right, good. So next week we will look into the, we'll go over this, but I also want to let you know I'm going to talk about the 36 verbalizations. And then we'll have a question about it to kind of practice a little bit with it and contemplate it. And then that'll be the end of our craving, and we'll move into more strength around, more strengthening this sense of self, more so with clinging next month. All right? Good. Rob?
So then just the last thing I want to say is just about Donna. And, you know, you don't have to pay anything to come to Sims. And Sims, you know, will never turn anybody away for inability to contribute Donna. However, I will say, or, you know, that Sims is a volunteer organization and can't exist without Donna. And our teachers also need your support. So, you know, for those of you who are able, and I know that many of you may not be with the current situation, but for those of you that are, I would just ask that you keep it in mind. And you can donate at seattleinsight.org/donate. And I'd especially ask that you consider supporting our teachers, because their ability to teach right now has been severely impacted. So your generosity is very. Thank you. That's all I have.
Okay. Thank you, Rob.